Will getting rid of antibodies help transplants?
Reversing the effects of our newer blood thinner?
How many Americans actually use prescription opioids?
And medical board certification. Show me the money.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on August 4th, 2017. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I pushed back at you from a study that is in JAMA this week. This one, where you said, hey, show me the money. What's going on with fees for medical specialty boards?
The process of board certification plays a pretty central role in self-regulating physicians, particularly in ensuring that they meet a certain standard across the nation. So after medical school, you do residency training, and then after that, you sit for your board examination that should confirm that you've met a certain standard. Those board examinations are administered by the American Board of Medical Specialties. What these investigators did was they compiled the fee structures for the initial certification and the ongoing maintenance certification for about 22 different specialties. And then they looked at the American Board of Medical Specialties to see what the tax returns of that organization have been over the last 10 years. And here's what they discovered. In 2017, the mean fee for the initial written examination, just across the board on average, is about $1,850. Now, 14 of these 22 exams also have an oral component. That's another $1,700. So we're spending over $3,000. And then about 19 of the boards offered some maintenance of certification. Well, over the last decade, the assets of the organization have grown from about $232 million to over $635 million. How much of that of the annual fees are spent on administering their exam? Only about 20%. 40% of the fees are spent on actually personnel. Physicians have been sponsoring a huge increase in the net assets of the organization that is allegedly nonprofit.
Okay, so it's interesting information, but what's the action point here?
Well, the cost of the physicians are pretty substantial. I think we need to do a cost-benefit analysis, and personally, I think we need to hold the American Board of Medical Specialties to a fiduciary responsibility. I think this needs to be examined.
Okay, well, maybe you could spearhead that effort. What do you think?
I think I'd have a lot of enthusiasm from around the United States. These tests are expensive, especially for people who have just completed their residency training. We need to be responsive to these individuals in particular.
Okay, that's the political statement for this week. Let's turn from here then to the New England Journal of Medicine, one that I think is really important. Gosh, when somebody has a transplant and they got a bunch of antibodies floating around in there, that really complicates whether or not that transplant is going to be successful. And then when we look at specific circumstances where people have to have more than one transplant, which happens frequently in kidney transplantation, well, gosh, what happens then? And a new way to deplete antibodies.
So there are over 105,000 individuals in the U.S. waiting for a kidney transplant now. And as you suggest, many of them have antibodies to other tissue that they've acquired because they've had previous transfusions, for example, or it can be acquired during pregnancy. So when we try to match kidneys, if the recipient has a lot of antibodies, they have a much higher risk that they'll have acute rejection. We have some ways of depleting that, but they're expensive and they're not altogether effective in all individuals. Well, there's a bacteria called Strep pyogenes that actually produces a particular protein called an endopeptidase that actually degrades antibodies. So they did phase one studies looking at what the proper dose would be. Then in 25 individuals that were considered to be at high risk for kidney transplant, they provided them the endopeptidase prior to their transplant to try to decrease the antibodies, specifically the IgG antibodies. And in those 25 individuals, they were successful in transplanting the kidney in 24. When they measured the IgG antibody, it fell about 100%, and it stayed that way for about 2 to 4 weeks, depending upon other type of immunosuppressive therapy they delivered. But it does show this is an effective way of rapidly decreasing the IgG antibody in people that are hyperimmune.
And that's really good news for those folks who need a kidney transplant, and as I suggested, especially those, I mean, I've seen patients who've had 3 or 4 kidney transplants, so those people certainly have a tremendous number of antibodies. I guess I am concerned about the long-term risk of depleting IgG. We know that this, of course, is one of those memory kind of immunoglobulins that's hanging around to protect us. And I'm sure this enzyme is not specific.
There are four classes of IgG antibody, and this particular enzyme cleaves only the IgG, but all four classes. These are antibodies that are important for preventing infection. So one wonders if it's applied to 100 or 1,000 individuals, will they have an increased risk of infection? We need larger studies, but in this small pilot study, it is very promising.
I guess I'm also wondering about maybe the utility of administering immune globulin to these folks after transplantation.
What additional or supplemental therapy needs to be given to these individuals will be worked out in the future. But you're right, this may be just one part of a multimodal therapy.
Since we're in the New England Journal of Medicine, then let's turn to, we've got this drug, dabigatran, an anticoagulant. How about if we need to do surgery on these folks and we need to reverse that?
The anticoagulant that's been around the longest has been Coumadin or warfarin, but it has some downsides to use. You have to monitor it, and there are bleeding complications. It's hard to regulate. The newer oral anticoagulants called NOACs, newer oral anticoagulants, have a better safety profile, don't require monitoring, and they have a much more predictable anticoagulant effect. The downside is we haven't had effective ways of reversing them. So, for example, if someone's on one of these, and they're in an accident and need emergency surgery, or if they have bleeding episodes without any way of reversing it, many physicians have been reluctant to prescribe these medications. This is where antibody therapy can be particularly helpful, because there is a particular antibody called idarucizumab that binds specifically to dabigatran and can potentially neutralize effects very quickly. So what these investigators did was they took 501 individuals that were either bleeding or needing some type of urgent surgery, and they were all on dabigatran. And they provided them a single dose, 5 grams of intravenous antibody specifically targeted to dabigatran. What they discovered is when they gave this, within 4 hours, the reversal of dabigatran was 100%. For the patients that were bleeding, the time for the bleeding to stop was about 2.5 hours. And for the individuals that needed surgery, it was usually done within an hour and a half of administering this antibody. 93% of them had the surgery without any bleeding difficulties at all.
Sure, and we know that there's tremendous number of clinical benefits to these agents, the newer ones, because they don't require someone to come to a clinic and get their coagulation monitored and all that sort of stuff. So this is good news.
It's terrific news. The other thing that I should mention is there was really no adverse safety events. I think this will help increase the use of these newer oral anticoagulants.
Finally, our last study for this week is from Annals of Internal Medicine. I said, how many people in the U.S. take opioids on a yearly basis?
We have mentioned this before, and that is over the last 15 years, overdoses resulting in deaths from opioids has quadrupled in this particular study. It's a 2015 National Survey on Drug Use and Health, which was analyzed by the investigators, and there are over 51,000 people that completed this survey. I was surprised to learn that a third of U.S. citizens use opioid annually. About 15% misuse it. The most common reason for misuse is actually chronic pain. And the individuals that are most likely to do it were the uninsured, the unemployed, low income, or had behavioral health problems. These are the individuals that are most at risk in the United States.
These data, of course, are informative in helping us to understand more about this opioid problem that is national and actually international, but certainly we're dealing a lot with it right now. As you know, there was discussion this week by the President's Commission on this issue that we ought to declare this problem a national emergency. What are your thoughts about that?
I'm actually in favor of that. I think we need to focus a significant amount of attention on this. And the attention just isn't on the individuals that are misusing it, but it's upon the health system that actually has fostered this over the last several decades. For example, about 40% of these individuals obtained opioids free from their relatives or friends. That means the relative or friend got a prescription for a doctor, oftentimes short-term use. They had some left over, and they provided it to their friends or relatives. Well, we shouldn't be prescribing opioids unnecessarily. We know that there's no studies that suggest it's beneficial for long-term pain relief. We have other alternative ways, but we don't have the processes in place, or we're not paying attention to do that. Nor are we targeting or looking specifically at the patients that are most at risk, the patients I talked about. So this is a societal issue. We have more deaths from opioid overdose now than we do from motor vehicle accidents. Unless we address it on a national level, we're not going to be able to solve this problem.
And I think your point is really well taken with regard to physician prescribing behavior, because another thing that we've seen is that physicians need to know not just how to give them, but how to wean their patients off of them and make sure that they do go to alternative methods of pain relief.
And how to identify patients that may have use disorders that predispose them to opioid abuse. And also, we need to be able to have time to spend with our patients. It's easy just to write a prescription for an opioid and send the patient out. It's a little bit more difficult to know what the alternative methods are and to spend time explaining that to the patient. And maybe we do that not with physicians, but healthcare extenders as well.
Very good. This week on the blog, I'm going to talk about the antibody depletion strategy for kidney transplantation in New England Journal of Medicine. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.